سعید پورزا، لندن.
رشان سگلم، استانبول.
سید امین عالمی، کابل.
شهان بات، اندین ادمنستریت کشمیر.
Around the world with reporters.
The Yemeni Ministry of Health and Population held a press conference in Sana'a to highlight the impact of the continued Saudi siege on the national drug supply program. The event took place amid a severe shortage of necessary medication in the war-torn country.
The Saudi blockade imposed on the national drug supply program has caused one of the world's worst crises in the health sector. Medicines do not arrive on time at all due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history.
Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new air strikes. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
Days after going to the polls, the United States remains in electoral limbo. Dozens of elections for the House of Representatives still remain undecided, while control of the Senate is also up in the air as two narrow races are still counting their votes. Just like in 2020, multiple battleground states have had controversial outages of their voting machines and surveillance equipment, leading to more questions by candidates and voters about the integrity of America's elections.
It speaks volumes, and we see these problems happening everywhere. If you ask me, a very common sense solution is to stop using all this technology to vote, because technology is easily hackable. None of it's secure, despite what anyone wants to say.
Projections show that Republicans will take the House, while the Senate will likely come down to a runoff vote next month. Democrats are trying to spin the idea that they could have lost worse as a positive outcome, but without definite results, political life is on hold with major consequences.
Going back to George Bush's own first election over Al Gore, you saw that it was in Florida, where George Bush's brother was the governor, that the ballots took forever to be counted in. So all of this technology, the oligarchy that we have even in America, these problems are not limited to the third or the second world. They're right here in America.
President Joe Biden indicated he will run for re-election, even though a recent poll showed that 72% of the United States doesn't want him to run, and that includes 56% of Democrats. Ex-President Donald Trump continues to separate himself from the mainstream Republican leadership, as he's expected to announce next week that he's running in 2024, refusing to wait until after the crucial Georgia Senate runoff vote next month. The latest inflation numbers barely edge downwards, meaning that the average American is now suffering from both economic and political instability. Mass layoffs, which had been delayed until after the election, have already started, as the world keeps moving forward, even if America's electoral results do not. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The
EU's executive arm, the European Commission, suggests the bloc's economy will have contracted for a six-month period up to the end of March 2023. This means recession. Inflation is forecast to stay high for longer than initially anticipated. Uncertainty surrounds the medium to long-term picture also.
The largest threat comes from adverse developments on the gas market and the risk of shortages, especially not this winter, but next winter.
As EU energy sanctions against Russia appear to backfire, business and consumer confidence continues to decline across the 27-country bloc.
We're very concerned, particularly for people that are on lower incomes that are very much affected by the higher energy prices.
I'm afraid that it can get much worse before it gets better.
The price of the energy is so high. The price of the products, I think it's a thing of everything.
EU leaders firmly blame Moscow for the crisis amid the conflict in Ukraine. However, some commentators claim the United States has used NATO to manufacture the war.
America is fighting against multilateral world, but basically is fighting against our freedoms, democracy, and everything it pretends it stands for.
The EU says it will continue to fund the Ukrainian army and government no matter what the cost. Back home, the only good news is that employment figures remain positive. Just modest damage to the EU labour market is forecast for 2023. It is an area that is being monitored very closely by the Commission, as there's broad consensus. A sharp rise in unemployment would represent the final nail in the coffin for the EU economy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Diplomatic tension between Italy and France keeps mounting as the French NGO-run search and rescue ship Ocean Viking reached the French port of Toulon with its load of 234 asylum seekers on Friday. The ship had been refused a port of safety by Italy's far-right government for around 3 weeks, a decision that the French government slammed as irresponsible and inhumane. In response to the situation, Paris suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees currently in Italy, calling on all the countries in the EU's migrant relocation mechanism to adopt similar measures.
The Ocean Viking, NGO ship that docks in France today, is the first NGO ship to have ever docked in France, and it has 234 migrants. This generated a very tough reaction with respect to Italy, which has allowed almost 90,000 immigrants to enter since the start of the year. 90,000! All NGO ships dock in Italy. What makes us angry? That Italy has to be the only country to provide a disembarkation port. This is not written in any agreement. France's response was aggressive and unjustified.
A third of the 234 asylum seekers on board the NGO ship will be relocated in France, while 4 passengers with serious health difficulties were transferred to a French hospital. This is not the first diplomatic rift between Italy and France in recent years. In 2019, Paris recalled its ambassador to Rome for consultations after then Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio urged members of the Yellow Vest movement to continue with a protest against the French government.
There is a clear resemblance between the rift that took place in 2019 and the present one. Both cases are just a mere provocation on the part of nationalist, populist Italian executives. This tension between Italy and France is the result of the insubstantiality of the EU's migration policy.
While EU countries keep failing to collectively assume responsibility on the migrant issue, around 20,000 asylum seekers have died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea since 2014, while tens of thousands are stuck in Libyan detention centers where torture, sexual violence and abuse are rife. Max Civili, Rome.
Walthamstow, a town in East London, home to more than 150,000 people and the longest outdoor market in Europe.
It also happens to be one of the poorest areas, where a national cost of living crisis is pushing more and more people to the brink. And less money in people's pockets has meant less business for the shops and stalls here.
Couple that with soaring utility bills and increased prices that make running a successful business a real challenge.
My weekly sale is like half and half now, this time especially. For example, I'm earning about a weekly 1,000, for example, it's go 5. It's half and half now. And the people are scary, they don't spend much. They are very choosy now.
Quiet, very quiet. We see the market empty. Because we have people, but like pass, just on the pass. Nobody do shop because they don't have money. But rent now high. But energy right now very, very high. Gas high. And because that expensive right now.
The cost of living crisis has fed into the housing market as well, forcing Anne, who works in a coffee shop, to move house.
A couple months ago, I was living in a house share, but the landlord got really, like, worried about the cost of living, and he, like, tried so hard to, like, increase the prices little by little, and we ended up, like, having an argument about it, and he ended up, like, evicting me because, like, I didn't think it was fair, but he was forcing us to do stuff. So now, like, I'm paying, like, a really high price for, like, such a small room, no, like, living room or anything.
More than 6,000 people in this area claim universal credit. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of the children here live in poverty. Desperate parents and households are having to rely on charities such as this one to get by. We were told the Roxana Khan Foundation Food Bank gives donations to an increasing 300 households every week. Inflation remains stubbornly in the double digits. The government has hinted at increased taxes and cuts to public spending. Many here and across the UK will find it even more difficult to make ends meet. Saeed Puriza, Walthamstow, East London.
A recent study published in the Indian Journal of Ophthalmology reveals that a large number of those who sustained eye injuries due to the use of pellet guns in the mainstay of Srinagar between July and November 2016 have suffered some degree of vision loss. The survey conducted on 777 eye operations during the period reveals 80% of the victims have vision limited to counting fingers. 35-year-old Arshid Ahmed, a student of arts, was hit by pellets in both eyes in October 2016. 6 years on, Arshid says his vision of higher studies diminished just like his eyesight.
Initially, I thought things might get better after the operation, but as time passed, it started to get worse. The most hurtful thing for me is that I am dependent. I feel I'm a burden. How long will my family be able to support me?
Arshid's family was more fearful than hesitant to talk, and convincing Arshid to speak to Press TV about his condition was no less than a Herculean task.
I'm often confined to my room. Darkness is my future, although the government has bragged about rehabilitation and support for pellet victims. We're left to helplessness and nothing else, and speaking about my helplessness has now become a crime.
Before the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in 2019, New Delhi used shotguns for almost a decade to quell anti-India demonstrations in Indian-administered Kashmir, resulting in thousands of pellet injuries and the epidemic of vision loss in the region. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, people here might be upset about many things changing in the region. However, a remarkable achievement for government forces is that not even a single pellet gun has been used in the region following a tough crackdown on protesters. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan for decades. Both lay claims to the region but rule it in parts. India regards Kashmir as an integral part of its territory. Meanwhile, analysts say since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status, New Delhi seems to own everything in Kashmir except the problems of its people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea Air Force drills extended into last weekend as North Korea launched more missiles.
Pyongyang argues U.S.-led military exercises revived this year are a rehearsal for invasion. Amid reports North Korea may conduct a seventh nuclear test, U.S. officials warned Pyongyang the use of nuclear weapons would end its regime. In South Korea Thursday night, university peace activists gathered for a vigil outside the U.S. embassy, calling for an end to the U.S.-South Korea-Japan alliance and removal of President Yoon. The U.S. has also conducted renewed joint drills with Japan, including a naval fleet review as Tokyo seeks to normalize its military activities.
North Korea faces much stronger conventional forces in the U.S.-South Korea alliance, which is at least partly why it showcases its missile and nuclear deterrence. With the U.S., South Korea, and Japan all bolstering their weapons and military drills, the questions are if and when North Korea will conduct a seventh nuclear test. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Ongoing Israeli military raids to the occupied West Bank area continue under different pretexts. Early on Wednesday, regime forces raided Balata refugee camp in Nablus, killing Palestinian teenager Mehdi Hashash and seriously wounding several others. Dozens more Palestinians suffered suffocation due to tear gas inhalation.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The Israeli military said it carried out the attack to secure a visit by settlers and members of the Israeli parliament from the Likud party to Joseph Stump, located near Balata refugee camp. The military said in a statement that the Palestinian gunmen fired in the direction of a convoy carrying the party members. The attack comes as the Israeli Knesset members are celebrating the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, the Likud, in the recent elections.
Over the last 7 years, we have been resisting the Israeli aggression. We have witnessed escalation of tensions, while calm has prevailed on some occasions. But the current transitional cabinet in Israel needs to prove that it's a right-wing cabinet. I think with the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians, we might witness a real third intifada.
In addition to the military raid to Nablus, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah, Bethlehem, and Al-Khalil. Regime forces arrested over a dozen Palestinians, accusing them of carrying out terrorist acts. Palestinians who have been confronting Israeli military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases. But it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods, and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter, but now I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights we only eat bread with tea. We could use the aids if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy. The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Emirzadeh, Kabul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
With the increase in the prices of gas, electricity, gasoline, and the intensifying inflationary pressure on the consumers, one out of every six American households is unable to pay their electricity bills. Most Americans do not accept President Joe Biden's explanation for the higher prices of gasoline and fuel, and say he has performed poorly in managing the U.S. economy in general. The U.S. President Joe Biden claims that Russia is responsible for the increase in the price of oil and gas, but a new opinion poll shows that only 1 in 10 Americans, or about 11%, agree with this explanation. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The New York Times reports, gas, electricity, and gasoline prices in the United States are creeping higher, reversing a months-long streak of declines and chipping away at a potent talking point for the Joe Biden administration, which has been emphasizing its success at easing pressure on the American public since this summer. Though the uptick has followed a rise in crude oil prices, analysts point out to two new factors that are also pushing gas and gasoline prices higher: a loss of refining capacity in California and Ohio, and rising demand in recent weeks. According to data from the American Automobile Association, the AAA, the national average price of regular gasoline stood at $3.89 a gallon on Friday, 7th of October, climbing for more than 2 weeks. That's lower than the record of about $5.02 a gallon reached in June of this year, but still higher than usual for this time of the year. Prices have made a particularly big leap in California. At about $6.39 a gallon, prices are close to the state's June record of $6.44 a gallon. Gas prices there and in other western states, including in Nevada and Arizona, jumped after several refineries in the region closed for maintenance. The rise, should it last, could increase pressure on the White House to act quickly to bring down prices. A spike in gas prices, which followed a surge in crude oil and other energy costs after Russia's conflict with Ukraine, became both a political liability and a policy headache as consumer prices rose across the board. President Joe Biden, who over the summer responded to the increase in gas prices by chiding energy companies for profiteering on consumers, released oil from strategic reserves and encouraged Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. Gas prices eventually started to decline. The global oil prices tumbled amid rising concern about the slowing of global economy and demand eased. The recent jump means White House officials have been pressed to address the issue once again. Brian Deese, the director of the National Economic Council, said on Thursday, 6th of October, that energy companies need to lower prices at the petrol pump. Analysts say the refinery shutdowns will be temporary, and the fact that Americans tend to drive less in the winter months could keep prices from climbing as sharply as they did back in June. But a recent rebound in crude oil prices, which rose nearly 17% this week as the world's major oil producers agreed to cut production, means predicting what's next will be difficult. The Hill has covered the same story, but from a different angle. According to a Gallup poll released recently, the American public's view of the economy are declining as gas prices are rising. Two-thirds of the American public surveyed in the poll conducted recently said that gas prices are causing a moderate or severe financial hardship on their household. That figure marks an increase of 15 percentage points from the 52% who said the same back in April, and is among the highest that Gallup has found when posing the question during periods of gas price increases since 2000. Meanwhile, Gallup's Economic Confidence Index, a summary of Americans' ratings of current economic conditions and outlook for the economy's future, dropped 13 percentage points from last month to minus 58. The index ranges from 100 if all respondents describe the economy positively to minus 100 if all respondents describe the economy negatively. The index's current score is the lowest since February of 2009, when the country was still experiencing the Great Recession. The all-time low was minus 72, recorded back in October of 2008. 8 out of 10 surveyed adults in households earning less than $40,000 a year said gas prices have caused a financial hardship, and 4 out of 10 describe it as severe. Almost 3/4 of respondents from the households earning between $40,000 and $99,999 reported a hardship, and 40% called it severe. Half of respondents from households earning more than $100,000 a year reported a hardship, and 22% called it severe. Aside from the political consequences, a sustained rise in gas prices could affect how businesses and consumers view the U.S. economy. In July, falling gas prices were a key part of the better-than-expected reading of the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, offering a brief glimmer of hope to those looking for signs that inflation has peaked. Russia Today has also covered the same story. According to a Rasmussen poll published recently, just 11% of the American public believe Russian President Vladimir Putin is to blame for record-high gas prices in the United States. The majority instead blame President Joe Biden. More than half, or 52% of respondents to the Rasmussen poll conducted recently, pointed to President Biden's poor energy policies as the reason gas prices have become unaffordable, meaning the administration's Putin's price hike narrative does not appear to be catching on. Those who blame neither Joe Biden nor Vladimir Putin point their fingers at oil companies, with 29% of respondents suggesting The industry is leveraging the current geopolitical instability to jack up its prices. Perhaps aware that his Putin's price hike narrative no longer holds water, Joe Biden has been leaning towards blaming oil and gas companies for the ruinous costs of fueling up, recently accusing the industry of making more money than God. President Biden has insisted that oil companies are deliberately holding back from drilling because they make more money not producing more oil. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recently warned that gas prices may spike again this winter. In an interview with CNN, Janet Yellen said gas prices could rise due to the European Union largely halting Russian oil purchases this winter and banning provision of services that allow Russia to ship oil by tanker. Janet Yellen said it is possible that that could cause a spike in oil prices. The price of gas is widely viewed as a critical issue heading into the midterm elections this November. Some 92% of voters saw the rising price of gas, home heating oil, and other fuels as a serious problem in recent opinion poll, with 68% of the American public calling the problem very serious. With no sign of an economic turnaround and elections coming this November, the Democratic Party is likely to be blamed for voters' economic suffering, and both houses of Congress may end up under Republican control.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
North Korea has been on a missile launch run lately. In one day, it tested fire 25 missiles. Why has North Korea been so aggressive when it comes to these launches? Is it to grab attention from the U.S.? Yet when it comes to North Korea, the U.S. President Joe Biden says the U.S., Japan, and South Korea are more aligned than ever on North Korea. Shouldn't they try to be more aligned with North Korea itself instead of among themselves, or at least with China? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Mike Billington, Asia editor at the Executive Intelligence Review, joins us from Hamilton, Virginia. Also joining us is Arnold August. He's an author and journalist who joins us from Montreal.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both, gentlemen. Mike Billington, I'll start with you. The amount of missiles that North Korea has launched is, in a sense, incredible. And one day, 25 missile tests were conducted. Why do you think that they feel that they have to launch so many missiles? What are they trying to say here?
Well, the obvious is that they're trying to demonstrate that they have the capacity to defend themselves and that they're willing to do so by attacking any source of attack from outside their borders. There may very well be other justifications which they have not made public.
Okay. Arnold August, let me ask you, in terms of the way that they have done this, analysts are saying that this is perhaps building to something bigger, like maybe a nuclear test, which the U.S. is anticipating, or a full long-range ballistic missile test out to be conducted to the Pacific, or both. Do you think that that is what North Korea is intending to do?
I think one has to look at North Korea, similar to what Mike just mentioned, from their own point of view, their own standpoint. It is quite obvious for some time, I would say since the last meeting of the big powers in Madrid, NATO, last June, for the first time, NATO and the West specifically mentioned that, yes, we're concerned about Russia, but our main fear is China. And then, of course, you had the very well orchestrated and deliberate sending by the Biden administration Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. And since then, it's been escalating. Now, in that context, I think that North Korea has every right to have nuclear weapons to defend themselves. One could just imagine if they did not have these weapons to defend themselves against the United States, it's quite possible that North Korea would have been overthrown by this time. Let us take the example, if I'm not mistaken, Gaddafi, he gave up on the issue of nuclear weapons. What happened after that? The United States invaded the country, killed the legitimate leader of that country in Libya, and has been going downhill since. So I think people are perhaps have to learn from history and put things into context and not allow the mainstream media to focus all North Korea, they're bad. They tested missiles, but what is the context?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you can tell us, Mike Balancing, whether these missile tests, along with the military exercises that the U.S. has conducted, whether it's with South Korea or with Japan, and also how it has been provoking China, such as providing, for example, Taiwan with arms, is all related, in a sense, to the way that North Korea has exercised these vast numbers of missile tests. I mean, are these things related?
Well, you know, everything is related in terms of the development of human history. The current global showdown, the global crisis being orchestrated virtually every day over many different aspects of the unfolding of history, the evolution of what has become a very near-term degeneration into global nuclear war centered around the Ukraine crisis. All these things are related. I think you really have to step back from the strategic nuclear confrontation, military threats, and so forth. It's required that you look at the global emergence of history as a from a single perspective in order to have a sense of what is going on in front of our eyes and what is rapidly escalating crisis situation that could become a war virtually overnight by intent or by mistake. That's the point of initiation of looking at this okay. descent to a nuclear war. But on the other hand, you also have to have a broader perspective and recognizing that the Western financial system is disintegrating. We're sitting on top of the greatest explosion of the dollar-based Western financial system in history. And it's this that's driving the war rather than the other way around. The feeble and ridiculous effort by some of the Western financial moguls to say that the current Western financial disintegration is being brought about by Russia's taking its oil and, and gas off the markets is totally absurd, first of all. It's not Russia that took its oil and gas off the markets. But it also is trying to separate the energy crisis and the general economic breakdown crisis in the West from its reality, which is 30, 40 years of crazy speculative printing of money, dollars and other currencies.
Let's take a look at what Russia has said, actually, since you've mentioned Russia over here. Arnold August, Russian foreign minister, has said that the U.S. and NATO are militarizing the Southeast Asia region in order to contain the interests of Russia and China in the Asia-Pacific. Now, I'm looking at that statement coming from the Russian foreign minister, and I'm asking you to whether you can put that into context for us when it comes to the way that actually the U.S., has said that both Russia and China can exercise their influence on North Korea. You know, you have the U.S. on the one hand that obviously is not on good terms with Russia, nor with China, really, in a sense, accusing them of a variety and host of issues, but yet they want to ask them to leverage their influence over North Korea. I mean, isn't that like having the cake and eat it too type approach by the U.S.?
Yes, it is. And I'd like to just add to that one point. Mike also said the necessity to look at the overall context and to dot the lines, dot the I's. So I would say, you know, we're looking at what region? It's a South China Sea. What is the key country in the South China Sea? There's only one, the People's Republic of China. And so, in my view, if you want to look into the context, the current offensive by the United States and its allies, including Canada and Europe, began, say, in 2014 in Russia when NATO launched its offensive to push Russia to the brink, where it had no choice to defend itself against NATO incursions right on the border of Russia. And I have said that before, and I'll say it again. While it is obvious the main target on NATO and Western countries is Russia, but the ultimate goal of these countries is to weaken Russia, not just as a phenomenon as such, but as part of the growing alliance between Russia and China, which also includes many other countries, such as BRICS, which is exploding. Every time we have an interview here on Press TV, we talk about the number of countries that are joining BRICS. Well, since the last conference here, there's been several other countries joining. So my view is that everything that's happening, whether it's in Eastern Europe or in the South China Sea, the main target is China. And I would not say just to contain China, as the United States puts it diplomatically, but the United States is not interested in containing anything. Right from this very beginning, the United States wants to control completely the countries of the world that they want to dominate. And those countries that stand up to U.S. domination, whether the United States admits it or not, the ultimate goal is regime change. Their goal in Russia is regime change. They want to get Putin out in order to have a government that is compliant with the United States. And the same thing goes, it's hard for them to talk about regime change and China, forget about it, but they're going to try everything to destabilize China and make it difficult for it to continue on the path of major economic developments that the whole world can now see.
Well, the U.S. is benefiting from this, though, in some sense, Mike Billington, if you agree. I mean, at this point, you had this massive war games that the U.S. conducted with Japan. Japan is now intimidated, and it wants, next month, it has announced that the government is going to double the defense budget over the next decade, and it's going to acquire long-range strike weapons. And, of course, that's going to come from the U.S. Do you think that that is obviously one intention the U.S. has when it comes to North Korea vis-a-vis militarizing that region?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. The Western financial system is in a state of total bankruptcy, which is increasingly recognized around the world, and that there's no easy fix, no solution to the bankruptcy. And therefore, many in the West, the so-called war party, which includes people from all the political parties in the U.S., both the Republicans and Democrats, who believe that pushing for war is the only way to start the money pumping for the military-industrial complex, as well as the interplay between the national financial institutions in Europe, in the U.S., in the developing sector, the South American banking interests, the African financial institutions, and so forth. So in that sense, yes, the diverting of funds to the money trading centers in the financial institutions, the hedge funds and the and other aspects of this, but in particular those that are tied to financing this war, which is, you know, demanding the printing of billions and billions, trillions even, of new credit being pumped out into the system. This is all interfaced. The Wall Street financier crowd and those who are making sure politically as well as financially that new credits are being issued regularly to finance the military-industrial complex. All of that is being waged full steam.
Okay. All right. So, you know, while Mike Billington was speaking there, Arnold August, I couldn't help but try to draw a comparison here, which I don't know if it's appropriate or not. So I'm going to ask you, when you take a look at the way that the U.S. is militarizing the region, we're looking at obviously some of the countries in particular like South Korea and Japan. It kind of looks like what it's doing in the area where Ukraine is. You know, you have all these NATO countries, and they're all being pumped with lots of weapons, with the threat being Russia. And here you have the threat being North Korea, and they seem to be ramping up that kind of approach. And interestingly, reports are suggesting that Japan is negotiating the purchase of these Tomahawk cruise missiles, which has the ability to strike targets deep inside China. So that seems to be in line with what they're doing in the Ukraine area. Is that an appropriate comparison?
I think it's more than appropriate, because what we're seeing now over the last few weeks, few days, is a NATO-style aggression led by the United States and their allies such as Canada and Europe against China. There's no doubt about it. With Taiwan, I guess one could say the proxy in this case is Taiwan, as Ukraine is the proxy against Russia in Eastern Europe. And I think it's important to analyze the fact that it was raised by Mike and yourself, like the whole issue of a currency that is outside of the control of the United States and Europe and Canada. This is a major breakthrough, a major project that is going on right as we speak. That's why I have to mention BRICS once again, that is burgeoning. And the main feature of BRICS, it has already started, and that is using currencies that are not American currency, even using credit cards that are not American credit cards. And this, I think, poses a very important danger to U.S. hegemony. And just, I would also say, amongst what the United States says are their closest allies in this latest provocation in the South China Sea, such as Japan and South Korea. Well, I saw millions of people demonstrating in South Korea against this type of militarization, and perhaps other countries as well. So the United States will not have it that easy, or not as easy, they think, to keep this coalition going against China, as they are, to a certain extent, much less extent, not able to really solidify all of the European countries behind the American pressures against NATO, if not the governments. Millions of people are demonstrating throughout Europe to get Europe out of NATO and stop American NATO arming of the Nazi regime in Ukraine. So there's a lot of things in play. Many things could come up in the next while. I would not be surprised if the United States may have some problem keeping control over South Korea and Japan.
Well, there's got to be something that needs to happen, because we're looking at how North Korea has conducted all these missile tests, Mike Billensing. At this point, do you think that the U.S. and its allies there are going to just have a wait-and-see type approach, or are they going to actually... I mean, what is the... it's confusing what strategy the U.S. is really using when it comes to North Korea. I mean, you had Jake Sullivan say that, well, the North Korean nuclear test would be a flagrant violation, were it to happen, of multiple U.N. Security Council resolutions. I mean, is that the best that the U.S. can do when it comes to North Korea?
I don't think anyone in the Biden government has any actual plan that has some positive outcome.
Okay, it looks like we may have lost. I'll ask that question from you. I'm sorry we just lost you there, Mark Billington, if you have us. Arnold August, same question to you in less than a minute, please.
Yeah. What, can you just repeat it rapidly?
Yeah, the U.S. approach towards North Korea. Are they going to wait and see what North Korea is going to do? Or are they going to lay out something that shows some logic behind anything that has to deal with North Korea?
I don't think the Biden administration has any plans at all with regard to that area of the world, aside from the long-term goal to destabilize China and eventually try to control it. So I don't think they have a plan. But they are forced to have a plan now, because the Koreans were courageous enough to respond to those drills right around their territory by firing their nuclear weapons as a warning, say, look, you are not entering Korea. We are ready to defend ourselves. The United States always has in their mentality that the other countries in the South eventually will bow down ally with the United States, but that is not going to happen with Korea, and it might not even happen in North Korea, and might not even happen with what they call are they